that's the big risk. It's the unknown unknowns that typically break the markets, because that's, as we said earlier, the markets have to try to price in that unknown unknown very rapidly. In 2008, it was Lehman. Nobody, you know, like I said before, I was sitting in my apartment. At that time, I'd sold my house, was trying to buy a new house. I'm sitting in an apartment, and, you know, on a Friday night and Saturday morning, Lehman's in bankruptcy and the market's falling apart. Nobody knew Lehman was coming.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart, welcoming you back for another weekly market recap at the end of the week here with my good friend, Lance Roberts. Hey, buddy, how you doing, Lance?
Well, it's Friday. Glad to be here. Another week in the books, and Monday's a holiday, so at least we get a long weekend.
Nice. Nice. Well, look, and maybe, just maybe, we get a little bit of a break in the abuse. At least that's what my theme for this week is going to be. There were still a couple of gut punches this week, but the past 48 hours have largely been kind of flat once the market just dropped 3% right at the open on Thursday. What are you thinking here? Are we potentially nearing some sort of, you know, at least short-term bottom here? Or are you worried that there's more to come?
Well, there's certainly risk. There's more to come here, but, you know, it's kind of an interesting thing. You know, there's the old saying that says the beatings will continue until morale improves. Yeah,
exactly.
And that's really kind of been the market. And all of a sudden now people are starting to get a little bit more optimistic, you know, about things. And so these beatings are now apparently starting to improve the bullish morale a bit. But look, there are some indicators here that suggest that we could be at or near at least a short-term bottom. And here's the issue is we won't know. You know, people that are going, oh, we're near a long-term bottom, maybe they're right, but we won't know until we actually form a bottom that holds, right? So we've got to form a bottom, break this downtrend that we've been in. There's a very defined downtrend channel from the peak of the market in January. I mean, you can just draw a line right across the top of every rally, the March rally, the April kind of bounce, the little May bounce. You just draw a line right down across the top of those. It's a very defined downtrend line that intersects with the 50-day moving average right now. So, you know, we could certainly have a bounce up to that downtrend, and as for now, that should be used to sell into until we actually can look back and say, okay, we've broken that downtrend, we've retested that downtrend, turned it into support, and now we've got more bullish dynamic behind the market. So now we can go allocate capital on the long side. Yes, you're going to miss the bottom, and that's completely okay. You'll have a much better opportunity to invest capital for a longer term play once you kind of get those confirmations coming in. But right now, markets are very oversold. Only 2% of stocks are above their 50-day moving average. Only 12% of stocks in the S&P 500 are above their 200-day moving average. The last time we were at those levels was back in 2008. Sentiment is extremely beaten up here. Our technical,
it's like the lowest it's ever been, right?
It's right down there at the bottom. Again, 2008 type levels. If you take a look at, you know, even other indicators around the market, CEO confidence has come down dramatically. You take a look at just investor sentiment as a whole, it's just vastly negative. Our technical indicators are all back at levels that we saw last in 2008, which were actually lower than even in 2020. So on a lot of different levels, you can look at this market and say, this market has wrung about everything out of it. The sell-off that we had on Thursday was the largest sell program that we've seen since 1928. It was in the top four largest sell programs since 1928. That was just a liquidation really across assets. And, you know, one thing that I've been warning about here on our weekly calls, you know, Adam is talking about energy stocks were very extended, very overbought here and due for a correction. That correction came with a vengeance this week as well. So we saw a lot of oil stocks, you know, down 20, 30% in a week. And that's unusual to see stocks move that rapidly, but that's kind of normal for commodity type stocks. So, you know, a lot of that long bias trade on the energy side, we've been warning about taking profits, reducing exposure, reducing risk, because once the indications that a recession was coming became more apparent, which happened this week, That's not good for commodity stocks because those are demand driven stocks. And that demand is now going to wane as we saw a lot of recessionary indicators tick up this week.
All right. Yeah. Great summary. And a number of important things you mentioned there. Let me start with the end, which is demand destruction, how that can impact commodity stocks, especially oil. You have warned on this program the past couple of weeks that oil could have a correction and that oil corrections tend to happen fast and furious when they do. This week, case in point, at least with the oil stocks. I recorded an interview earlier this week with oil expert, petroleum geologist Art Berman. I'll put up a link to it here for folks that are interested in really diving into that topic. But Art sings from a similar tune, slightly different reasons, Lance, but he goes through a lot of data explaining how, just on the correlation between oil prices and inflation alone, when inflation spikes the way that it's been doing now, price of oil follows. There's definitely a causal relationship there between the two. But when you see that spike in inflation, it's usually not all that long lived. And as it corrects, oil prices correct too. And, argument that we haven't really even seen that correction part yet, but it could be coming. And in Art's words, he expects oil prices to moderate to the downside over this year. And of course, that's just with the, high prices are a cure for high prices, the organic part of inflation. Of course, we also have the Fed out there very actively trying to bring demand down too. So you kind of have two big forces that are weighing on here. Now, look,
quick on that. I actually have an article coming out on Tuesday on our website at realinvestmentadvice.com. And I'm going through the entire oil backdrop. And I've got two charts in there that talk specifically to Art Berman's points. It's a chart of the very high correlation between inflation and oil prices. And the thing about oil prices and inflation is they don't, and I'm going to argue with Art Berman here a little bit. Now, sure. I have total respect for Art Berman, smart guy. But, it's kind of like word salad. Let's use the word moderate. And that's great. But oil prices don't moderate historically. They crash. And that's also the same way it is with inflation, because you have this inflationary spike and then you hit that breaking point in the economy and they come down very rapidly. And not ironically, but, and very much the same point. The Fed is now aggressively hiking rates, 75 basis point hike on Wednesday. And, they're talking about another 75 basis points at the next meeting, 75 or 50 after that meeting. Well, sharp rises in the Fed funds rate also have a very high correlation and negative impact to oil prices. And again, oil prices don't moderate lower. They tend to fall very quickly. And that's because of, again, let's go back to oil prices and how they run real quick. Oil prices are not driven by the supply and demand. I know we look a lot at supply and demand imbalances, right? We say, well, global demand is this and current supply is this, so oil prices should be here. That's all fine and dandy, but oil prices don't move on supply and demand, because if they did, they would be more gradual rises and more gradual declines. The reason that oil prices spike and fall is because it's driven by commodity traders on Wall Street, primarily the non-commercial hedgers. And when they start piling into these trades and through the options and futures markets, they are the ones that are setting these prices at higher and higher levels. And that's great on the way up because they're all piling into the same trade. Well, now they're all pretty much on that long side of the trade. So when somebody holds their hand up and says, I'm out, they all start unwinding those futures contracts. And that's why oil prices tend, go back and look at 2008, look in 2015, 16, look at 2018, those prices drop very quickly because of the unwinding of that, both the leverage and those contracts in the commodities market.
So I can't remember if I had talked to Art before we recorded last week, but so if I repeat myself, forgive me here. But so Art said, after we sort of did the main interview, we chatted for a bit and he was sharing with me that he was reading Carl Jung. And the reason why he said that he was reading him is because he said in his 40 years in the industry, he's actually found that psychology was much more predictive of oil prices than actual like real data.
Exactly.
And basically underscoring exactly what you're saying there. Yeah. So you're very good to you know, reinforce the fact that oil prices tend to correct volatilely. And I don't even know if Art would really take much disagreement with you there on that main point. And the key reason why we've been harping on this, Lance, is because a lot of people have been sort of chasing oil and hopping into it saying, hey, it looks like it's just going to go a lot higher from here. Everybody's talking about $150 a barrel, maybe $200 a barrel. And Russia's got all the world's oil now. And, you know, what's going to happen? I just want to repeat what we've been telling people, which is demand for oil could persist for a long time at these prices. But because of the dynamics we're talking about, it's more likely that it probably isn't, because, you know, commodity markets really try to, if there's a big move in price, commodity markets are trying to quickly react to any shortages that are out there, right? The lines of trade get redrawn very quickly as people try to basically take advantage of arbitrages. And if producers can bring more online, they will. And that's, of course, that's all on the supply side. The Fed can't really touch the supply side, but you can be sure that there are players out there that are trying to bring that gap down. Now, the Fed is doing what it can on the demand side, right? And by just slowing the economy, it slows the total global demand for oil. That eventually is going to bring oil prices down the same way that raising interest rates is going to increase mortgage prices and bring housing prices down as well, right? So long story short, you know, I'm bullish on oil for the long haul for a lot of the fundamentals that you and I have talked about, Lance, and I've Absolutely. Talked about with folks like Rick Rule, Lynn Alden, et cetera. But in the short term, I think you and I have warned people, if you're jumping in right now, just be aware of these dynamics we're talking about. And again, we just made this warning last week, and then here we are a week later where several oil companies have corrected by 20 or 30%. So just trying to make sure folks realize why we're delivering these warnings.
Yeah, no, and I think that's a brilliant point because look, I'm very bullish long-term on energy too. And, you know, we've done a lot of things that, you know, are not good for our energy production. And now, you know, this whole move to I don't want to make anybody mad here, but, you know, this whole move to green energy and, you know, ESG. And, you know, I've written, you know, several articles about, you know, the scam that is ESG. And, you know, that's all now coming to light that that's exactly what it is. And now what we're realizing is this whole move and, you know, to combat climate change and to vilify oil companies, maybe we got a little bit ahead of ourselves. And so now we're going to have to play catch up here, but we are going to play catch up. You know, as you look at, you know, oil production right now, we're running at about 1 million barrels less in production than we were at the peak of the markets in 2020. So, you know, we're not that far off. Production has been coming up. If you look at the rig count, that's been steadily rising here over the last, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 months. You know, from the lows when we had negative oil prices, you know, in 2021. So, you know, now that we're had this recovery, yeah, look, drillers are going to go out and they're going to drill. They're going to make money. You know, there's a big myth in the markets right now about the massive profit margins that refiners are making. And, you know, that's not true. Their profit margins are up a bit. They are making a bit more money with high oil prices. But remember, all their costs have gone up too. So they're not just raking in the money right now because everything is just, you know, $120 a barrel oil and they're just printing money. Yeah, oil companies are doing well. No arguments about that. But their actual profit margins haven't grown by nearly as much as you hear in the media because of the fact that, you know, wages have gone up. The cost of production has gone up. You know, the cost of extraction has gone up. The cost of inputs into the extraction process have gone up. They're all paying higher costs too, just like everybody else. And so there's always this give and take within the markets. It's never as clear cut as what we hear. But what we do know is that we've made political decisions and we've driven a narrative that has certainly put energy companies on their back foot and have certainly not provided the incentive to go out and drill. You know, if you know, there's, you know, a lot of talk right now is that, you know, well, oil companies need to step up and they need to produce more. They need to refine more. They need to do it for, you know, they need to be patriotic and get it out to the people. That's great. To build a refinery, you're talking about a multi-billion dollar project that's going to take 3 to 4 to 5 years to build and get off the ground. So these energy companies, if they're going to build a refinery in the U.S., they need at least 10 to 15 years of visibility that they've got the runway to not only go out and borrow that capital, but to build the plant and then have a return on that investment over a period of time. in this environment with this administration, that there's just no visibility. Even as Joe Biden's been talking about companies need to go drill more, he's backing right up on that statement. But in 5 years, we want to be off of oil. Well, if you're only giving me a 5-year window to drill, I'm not going to do it because I can't invest that capital. And then in 3 or 4 or 5 years, you're going to come in and put some regulation on me that you know takes away that profitability. So there's no incentive for oil companies to drill. Now that's and this is the thesis right now that we have on the longer term view of energy. Energy prices got way ahead of themselves. Energy stocks got way ahead of themselves. They need to have a correction. They need to get back into kind of price alignment. But again, the longer term thesis is that we're going to continue to have an undersupply of oil relative to demand, because again, it's great. If everybody drove an electric car, it would not change the dynamic demand for oil because all the petroleum inputs that go into everything. If you want to build an electric car, it takes a tremendous amount of petroleum products. If you want to build solar windmills or solar farms, whatever, it takes a tremendous amount of oil and petroleum to do that. Petroleum's in everything that we touch in our life, from the food you eat to the clothes you wear. It's not going to change that demand. And so the more that we do to restrict oil and gas production, the more costly it's going to be down the road. And it may sound great that we're all going to drive electric cars. The problem is electricity is going to be too expensive for you to drive your car.
Yeah. All right. Well, very, very well said. And you know, this kind of goes back to the demotivational poster. Government, if you hate the problems we create, just wait to get a load of our solutions, right?
Exactly.
It's funny. I was just talking to my 15-year-old daughter the other night about unintended consequences and how they really do tend to be more the rule than the exception, particularly sort of in the government mandated world. And I gave her a couple of really funny examples, but you know, ESG movements are a really good one. And again, you know, who can argue with, you know, a mission to, hey, let's make the world, you know, greener and let's try to ameliorate climate change and all that type of stuff, right?
Absolutely. Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that. But it's the application of it. And that's where government tends to oftentimes, you know, their solutions are worse than the initial problem, right? And you and I could, we could get to our rent early and spend the entire hour just on that alone, Lance. But it's a good point. I think we've given people their warning about, hey, if you're going to jump into oil stocks right now, you know, have your eyes wide open, certainly have some hedges in place or an exit plan or whatever.
Just real quick, you know, back in 2020, we were talking about buying energy stocks because everybody hated them, right?
Yeah, well, remember back in 2020, oil traded below $0.
Exactly.
For a brief
moment there. Right. And so we were buying energy stocks in 2020 because nobody wanted them. Well, we had at our investment policy meeting this morning, we had a very long and detailed discussion about buying tech stocks. And the reason is that now with the Fed hiking, and look, everybody hates tech stocks right now. And the benefit of what's going to drive tech stocks is going to be a decline in inflation, a decline in rates, which basically that discount rate goes up for earnings growth for those companies. I'm not saying today's the day to run out and go buy a bunch of Apple, Microsoft, and Amazon, but you know, as an investor, you know, we were talking about buying stuff that everybody hated back in 2020. We've been selling energy all this year. And every time we were selling it, it just kept going up even more. So we just kept trimming our positions back down. And we still, and by the way, just full disclosure, we still own our energy stocks. We just kept selling them down. And we sold some, you know, late last week. So, you know, we just keep reducing that position size down and it keeps growing and that's all fine and dandy.
Right. And just to be clear, you're practicing your gardening analogy you've talked about in previous videos here, and you're basically pruning the profits, right?
Right. And I'm still promising I'm going to write that article. I just haven't got around to it yet.
Okay.
So I'm going to do it. But tech stocks are the same way. Everybody hates tech right now. I mean, it is the most underweighted trade right now in most portfolios. Everybody's now gone super long energy. And nobody wants tech or bonds. And in an environment where you've got the Fed hiking interest rates, inflation breaks, the economy slips into a recession, you know, two of the areas that I want to be having a position in and starting to buy is I want to own bonds because that'll participate with a recessionary environment. but tech stocks are going to start to look a whole lot more attractive at that point. Again, not every tech stock, right? I don't necessarily want to go buy, you know, some of these meme stocks that were running around in the last couple of years. I want to focus on companies that actually make earnings, have revenue growth, have sales, have a real business plan. Those are important. But there's going to be some really, really good opportunities to make a lot of money. It's kind of like the old Wayne Gretzky saying about skating to where the puck is going to be. You know, that's what we need to be thinking about as investors. You know, the energy trade is mostly done for right now. So we got to be thinking about in the next iteration of Fed policy, economic environment, market environment, where's money going to rotate to next? And I think it's just important to start looking, you know, at some of these hated areas because those will tend to perform better.
Right. Okay. So I want to get into where the puck is headed on the macro side and really, you know, want to talk about the word deflation in just a moment, at least disinflation, then deflation. But before we get there, you're raising a really important question first I want you to address, which is, you've said, hey, look, the right time to buy is when, you know, people don't want to touch a stock or they don't want to touch the stocks in a certain sector or whatnot. And you just said, hey, tech's beginning to give off that aroma, right? But I think a big question here right now that people are wrestling with, understandably, is, okay, get that, Lance, but is this bear market over or are we just on a milestone on the way there, right? So what's the probability that all asset classes could continue to get sucked down if we're in a bear market that's not ending until the S&P is, you know, got a two handle, or even some people think a one handle or whatever, right? So how do you balance that with saying, okay, there's probability or possibility that the general market could go down a lot farther, but I want to start layering into the sector that looks, you know, pretty beat up here, right? How do you as a capital manager sort of assess how much to put in when?
Well, so remember, two things are, and that's a great point. One, like I said, we're just talking about, you know, tech stocks. And I hope everybody listening to this thing is like, man, he's crazy buying tech stocks. That's exactly what I want to hear. Because if everybody listening is going, man, tech stocks suck, they're all going to go to zero. That's exactly the right setup for buying an asset, right? I mean, you want everybody to hate it. And again, it's got to have good fundamentals. Some stocks deserve to be hated, and then some stocks deserve to go to zero. I can think of quite a few off the top of my head that need to go to zero. But there's going to be some really great quality companies. Look, and there's some of this new tech. Again, you know, we've really beaten up on Cathie Wood and ARK Investments, you know, since the beginning of the year. There's quite a few companies in her portfolio that deserve to go to zero, and I suspect before this is all over that we'll see more than a few of those companies in her portfolio either trade really close to zero or go to zero, right? So that's just a function of markets. But there's some companies in her portfolio that have been really beaten up and have real value. And, you know, like for instance, we were just, you know, talking about the other day, Intel is a good example. We're talking about, and I'm not recommending you go buy Intel right now. So don't anybody run out and just buy Intel. But this is just a stock that's popped up on our list that we're paying a lot of attention to right now. We're talking about onshoring semiconductor production because of the issue of lack of semiconductors, et cetera. Here's a company trading at 5-6 PE, right? They've been around forever. They've got a long track record. They're not going out of business anytime soon. They've got a hefty dividend yield right now for the stock. Stock's right. Been beaten to crap.
Huge moat for an essential technology product.
Yeah. And this is a company. Now, the problem with Intel is that they're behind the curve on innovation in terms of where chips are headed. So again, you know, I would buy Intel. So if I was going to buy Intel, and let me just be real, I'm not doing this yet. Okay. So, but this is, we're talking about strategy. If I was going to be adding Intel to my portfolio, I would back it with either an AMD or an NVIDIA that has that cutting edge on, you know, AI processing, video graphics, the things that kind of that are still kind of the growing thing. You know, NVIDIA does all the graphics cards for computers, video gaming, Bitcoin mining, et cetera. So you buy Intel for the value play, you back that with NVIDIA for the growth side of that portfolio, and you build that structure within that section of your portfolio that is going to be dedicated to semiconductors, as an example. That's an example, right? Don't, again, not saying go do that right now. But if you just take a look as a good example, if you take a look at chart of AMD and Intel, they've actually been, despite this beating that the market's taken over the last 2 months, both of those stocks have actually kind of just bottomed right around their lows. And they've kind of bounced around here. But in the last 2 months, while the market's been getting hammered, those stocks have actually kind of stopped going down, suggesting that maybe we're starting to get to the point that we're starting to see a match of between buyers and sellers, and maybe valuations are coming a bit back in line. Again, it's too early to make that call, but that's, you know, so when we're talking about these kind of strategies and markets and talking about how to allocate capital, you know, we've got to be looking ahead down the road as to where we want to be placed, and then trying to find those opportunities now. And again, with people hating everything at the moment, that's actually kind of a good sign from a contrarian investing standpoint. And I'm a big contrarian historically anyway. So I really like it when there's a lot of negativity in the overall market. Now, to your question, I didn't really answer your question. Your question specifically is, you know, where's the bottom of this market? I don't have any freaking clue. You know, we can look at the market technically. And if we draw a line from the March 2020 lows to the January peak, and then run a Fibonacci retracement level, and that's a bunch of technical mumbo jumbo. If you don't understand it, don't worry about it. It's not important. But there's some certain levels that we can call kind of support levels. We crashed through the first level of that resistance, which was the 38.2 retracement. We broke through that. So the next level of retracement is now the 50% retracement from the peak, and that's right around 3,500. And then below that, we've got the 61.8% retracement, which is right around 3,200. So I think there's a reasonable case that somewhere between 32 and 3,500, we may find a bit more of a lasting bottom for the market. Could it go lower? Absolutely. You know, for that to happen, you need to really have something crop up that is extra recessionary. What I mean by that is if we have a normal recession in the economy, I could expect to see 3,500 to 3,200 on the S&P. I think that's a reasonable bottom to kind of build for the markets. Could it be here? Yeah, we could be forming a bottom right now. That's certainly possible. If the risk, and if for the really bearish group that are expecting much lower levels, like a retracement back down to 2,400, which was the kind of lows we put in at the March 2020 bottoms, we could certainly get there as well. But I think we're going to need more of a event to occur, and some type of credit related event or some type of economic event that causes a contraction of the credit market. In other words, lenders just say, I'm done for right now until I sort this thing out. That's going to cause, when you have that credit event, that's what causes those bigger collapses within the market. Certainly a possibility with the Fed being very aggressive. We're now starting to see high yield spreads starting to blow out here a little bit. So we're starting to see those kind of initial consequences of potential credit cracks, right, that can lead to a bigger issue. So could the markets go lower from here? Yes. Could they go a lot lower from here? Absolutely. And that's why for now, this is the answer to your question. From a capital deployment standpoint, we're treating everything as a tradable opportunity. We're at the bottom of a trading range right now. We think there's a reasonable trade up to maybe 4,000 on the S&P. We closed out our short hedges yesterday and today. Look for that bounce, maybe 4,000. We'll put those shorts back on, and we might add a little bit of equity here just for a trading opportunity. If the market comes back down, that's great. We'll pull the hedges off again and then look for our next opportunity. Eventually, like I said earlier, this market will stop going down. It'll start to bottom. It'll base. It'll start to turn up. And when we see that kind of clear activity of a bottom being put in place, then we can just allocate capital, pull the hedges off, and kind of let portfolios start to do what they're supposed to do on their own. But right now, this is a trading environment. If you don't like to trade, don't know how to trade, leave it alone, because the risk to the downside outweighs the reward to the upside momentarily.
All right, great. Thanks. I'm gonna put a few words in your mouth on this topic, and you correct them any way you like. When you're considering something like this, you know, taking a new position in the tech sector because it's so beat up, but we still have unresolved direction on where the bear market, you know, is going to go from here. My assumption is first you're going to keep talking about it until you decide to do something about it, right? Correct. So right now you're just talking. You decide to do something about it, my supposition is that you're really going to be, you know, dribbling in initially, right? I know you've said you rarely ever take a big position right off the bat, but you'll probably be extra cautious initially because you'll be looking for some signs of confirmation on the larger bear market direction before you really start getting healthy in terms of the allocation. I see you kind of nodding here, but just let me know what you think.
No, that's right. So what we would do initially is let's just say that we wanted to build this position today. We buy 1% today. Our target allocation would be 4 to 5% of the portfolio. So we buy 1%. So the market can certainly kind of keep coming down, but there's certain stocks that'll bottom even though the market's declining as a whole. So let's just say that we think Intel's found a bottom. I'm not saying that at all, but let's just assume we are. We buy 1% today. Looks like the bottom's holding. The market's still declining. Intel's doing what it's supposed to do. Then we maybe add another 1% at some point when we feel a little bit more confident about the trade. Then the stock starts to rise. And as the stock rises, then we become much more confident about our position. Then we'll just keep adding to it, right? But we start at that one position. And then if the trade kind of falls apart, A, we don't have a lot of capital invested in that portfolio. We just take the trade off and say, well, you know, that our entry point wasn't the right one. We had that one wrong. Very minimal damage to the portfolio because it's such a small position weighting. But that way we can kind of navigate that risk a bit and take that opportunity in time to build a position that as our thesis begins to plan out and play out as we expect, then we can just keep adding to it. You know, one of the challenges or the problems that a lot of people do is they'll buy a whole big position at one time, then it goes against them. And then they get caught in the trap of, okay, well, as soon as it gets back to where I bought it, then I'll sell it and get out of it. Then it goes down more. And then they go, well, as soon as it gets back to where it was, you know, when I last said I was going to sell it, if it rallied, I'll sell it there. And then you're in that trap at that point. It just keeps going down and it just kind of devastates your portfolio. But that's why the process of planting a little bit slowly and letting it play out, going back to our gardening analogy, kind of let those plants start to sprout a bit, make sure that they're healthy. And then you start adding to them, tends to work out better over time.
Right. Yeah. You know, talking about that kind of mental bargaining that goes on when folks put too much in too soon, it just goes back to underscore the importance of psychology in markets. And who would have known that gardening and psychology were the two important keys to investing, folks? Anyways, folks who are watching, I hope you're enjoying kind of getting this glimpse deep inside the mind of a professional, capital manager here. So that if you want to, you know, leverage these insights on your own, or you're looking for somebody to work with, you know, hopefully you're getting a good idea of the types of things to be looking for. If you are liking this stuff, want more of it, folks, let us know in the comment section below. Okay, Lance, I want to go over to the deflation side of things, but sure. Real quick, again, to folks watching, two quick things. One is, as I always like to ask you to do, you know, like the channel, subscribe if you can. I've been hearing a lot from people though that the YouTube application is turning off the notifications, which is the little bell icon that's right next to the subscribe button. So I just want to take just literally, folks, 10 seconds here. If you can look down at the subscribe button, if you haven't subscribed yet and you'd like to, and the benefits of subscribing is you get notified every time we publish a new video here on Wealthion. Make sure that button's clicked. But even if you have subscribed in the past, everybody should click that little bell icon right next to the subscribe button. And it's that little bell icon, which is the thing that's going to send out the notification to you whenever we publish a new video on this channel. So, all right, with that in mind, Lance, so you were talking about, what could potentially push the S&P down below 3,000. And you said it's probably going to be, an event that we probably can't imagine what it is right now. But, going into a deep recession, could be that event, or at least could bring with it the types of events that could justify prices going down lower like that. And there's just some data I want to walk through. Before I do, real quick though, one thing that we haven't seen yet happen in this current bear market is the forward earnings estimates have not really come down that much. They're still projecting a fair amount of growth for next year. And could we grow that much next year? Maybe. No. Anything's possible, but yeah, no. Probability is it stretches the imagination at this point in time. So
yeah,
there is going to be a period of time if we continue on this trajectory where those guys are going to have to revise those downward materially. And that could be another shoe to drop in terms of what pushes, you know, general asset prices down.
Okay. Yes and no. Okay. So MarketWatch reached out to me last week and asked me to write an article on the earnings recession.
Sorry to interrupt. I don't think I've mentioned a topic that you haven't written an article about. Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
So I just wrote it. So if you go to if you just Google earnings recession, Lance Roberts, it'll come up. And so the article is published over at MarketWatch. But precisely to your point. Now, here, let me clarify one thing that you said. Right now, we're seeing a lot of data and we're saying, okay, look, a recession's coming and that's what could cause this deeper market, right? Now, one thing you said correctly is that, you know, it'll be something that we're not even thinking about. The thing that causes the market to go down materially is guaranteed. It's nothing that we're thinking about right now because that's
it's not priced in. Yeah,
that's exactly. It's not priced in. There's too many people talking about a recession. So if a recession, so if the NBER came out tomorrow and said, hey, recession started in May, everybody go, yep, we knew that, you know, that's already been priced into the market up to this point. So just a recession announcement, I don't think is going to do the trick. One thing that hasn't been priced into your point is earnings. Earnings estimates have come down about 5% from their peak in January through actually January, February, March, April. Earnings estimates were still going up. And they've only recently started coming down. They're down maybe 4 or 5% from their peak for 2023 earnings, but those have got to come down 15 to 20% before you get through a recessionary period. So the point about that is two things to be careful of is forward earnings estimates and forward earnings valuations. Right now, people are going, well, stocks look pretty cheap here based on forward PEs, right? We've got forward PEs all the way back to where they were in 2019. Okay, well, first of all, PEs were expensive back in 2019. So yeah, we're back to where we're for grossly expensive, just back to expensive.
Right. Less overpriced doesn't mean cheap. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. But the thing about forward valuations is that the P has come down. So let me back this up. So to calculate valuations, if you don't know, it's price divided by earnings. So I take, you know, the price of Apple at $100 a share, and I take their earnings at $10 a share, and I divide price by earnings, and I get a division of 10, right? 100 divided by 10 equals 10. So their PE is 10 times earnings, right? So we go, that's pretty cheap. The problem is the P has come down, right? So valuations have come down, but the earnings haven't come down yet. So when the E starts to come down, that's going to cause valuation, assuming price doesn't keep coming down, that's going to cause valuations to go up, not down. So all of a sudden, that forward PE is not nearly as cheap as you think it is. And so the risk to investors and the problem is the problem with forward PEs is they're based on operating earnings. The problem with operating earnings is that it's called operating earnings without any reality to them. So I'm trying to think of a polite way to say what we say in Texas.
Fantasy earnings? Yeah.
Yeah. So operating earnings are simply the earnings if nothing else went wrong, right? If you didn't have a recession and everything, it's kind of like the Congressional Budget Office with their 10-year budget outlook. They never predict a recession, right? Interest rates are always low. Inflation is always low. There's never a recession. And so their budget projection looks great. And that's why they're always wrong. Forward operating earnings are the worst earnings you should ever use to do your fundamental analysis. You know, we got away from using GAAP earnings about a decade ago because it made it too difficult for companies to actually meet estimates. And for corporate stock buyback plans and executive compensation, we needed this kind of earnings to fantasy comparison, which was operating earnings. So the problem is those things are going to come down sharply. So if you're buying something today thinking it's cheap today, it's not based on forward earnings. Look at your trailing earnings, because that's going to be more important going forward. So, you know, this whole valuation process within the markets has still got to work its way through, and we've got a long ways to go. And that's the whole point of this forward earnings article that we wrote, is that those forward earnings have to come down a lot. Prices can still fall, but those earnings have to come down a whole lot before we get to see what real valuations are going to look like.
All right. So here we go then. We just need to have some correction anyways to map to the trajectory that we're currently on, which is what you're saying.
Yeah.
But as we look at the forward trajectory, you know, it's getting darker, not brighter at this point in time. So we oftentimes bring up the Atlanta Fed GDP now. It's been getting downgraded all through the quarter. They just downgraded it again. It's now at 0%. Oh, you're waving.
No. I just listened to Jerome Powell. He says there's no recession on the horizon. So, you know, just because the Atlanta Fed is at zero right now, that there's no recession on the horizon. Just, you know, don't be throwing that Atlanta Fed thing out here to me.
Yeah, I know. We should be like Chardon Schultz, right? Oh, we see nothing wrong. But yeah, so Atlanta Fed has now downgraded Q2 GDP to 0%, and we still have a few weeks left in the quarter, so that could drop negative. A reminder that Q1 was negative 1.5%, so we definitely have net contracted so far for the first half of 2022, and you know, back-to-back negative quarters of GDP is sort of a technical definition of a recession. So by some measures, we'll be in one when the quarter ends. So anyways, we've got that, you know, we've got that kind of green light of like, okay, yeah, those that are worried about recession, you're right to be concerned, because GDP ain't going nowhere right now. You and I have talked about demand destruction. We spent a fair amount of time last time talking about it. I do think it's worth talking about it again here. I've had two really good interviews in between the time you and I have talked, Lance, one with Lynn Alden. I'll put up a link to that here. And then one with Stephanie Pomboy. I'll put up a link to that here too. There were two really great discussions that go deep into how, you know, the next year or so, demand destruction really is going to be a key, if not the key theme, in terms of the destiny that we're going to be inheriting here in the short term. And why this is so important is we're so... Everybody is so fixated right now on inflation, which is totally understandable. You know, you and I talked last week because we were talking on the day that they had just released the May CPI number, which came in at a 41-year high, 8.6%. I just took a long trip up to Oregon. I live in California, 10 hours in the car, paying ridiculous amounts for gas. I mean, everybody is seeing it in their real life when they go to the grocery store, when they fill up at the tank. Totally understandable why we're so fixated on it. But I think when we talk about where the puck is heading, we're seeing demand destruction. We've been seeing the seeds getting laid for it. We're now beginning to see them sprout. And we could very well be in a scenario later this year, next year, where there's a real earnings recession, like you were just talking about, because companies are just making an awful lot less because overall macroeconomic demand is down. But where we could see prices, believe it or not, we could see lower prices ahead in a lot of key areas. Goods, in many cases, are already beginning to roll over here in certain key elements. You know, lumber is a great example of that. Here's just a headline I just pulled off the internet. Deflationary tsunami on deck. And here's a quote from Moody's. There are going to be discounts like you've never seen before, says Mickey Chadha, a Moody's investor service analyst who tracks the retail industry. We've seen the reports that have come out recently from Walmart and Target and Amazon showing that they basically did not see the consumer demand show up in Q2 that they had planned for. So they now have, you know, huge spikes in unsold inventory. So, you know, these are topics that maybe seemed unfathomable just a couple of weeks ago, we could really be entering a future very different from the one in which we've been living in for the past year. And I just want to raise all this because I want to make sure that while people are understandably really looking at what's going on in inflation, the bigger, longer term risk here may actually be severe disinflation and deflation. What do you think?
I think you're absolutely right. You know, one, it's this, I want to know who runs these. I want to know who runs Walmart, Target, and Amazon, because could you not understand that you had this whole massive influx of liquidity from the government that you knew was going to run, you know, basically run dry as soon as it ran through the system? So you saw this surge coming in. Why did you overstock inventory thinking this was some kind of organic growth cycle? You know, whoever their guy is, they need to get fired. So, because we were talking about this a year ago, is that, you know, we talked about the sugar. We wrote an article in 2020, actually, talking about the sugar rush, and that all this liquidity coming into the system was going to create this sugar rush of activity in the economy, and then it was going to be gone. And just like you know, if you give your kid too much sugar and, you know, they run around like crazy for about 30 minutes and then they're curled up in a corner somewhere taking a nap. And that's where we are in the economy. So how these guys didn't see this coming is beyond me. But this is how corporations always work. They always expect whatever's happening to continue indefinitely. I don't know if you paid attention to retail sales this past week, but we got the retail sales number out, and it was down 1% month over month. Now it was down the month over month change was negative 0.3%, but last month it was up 0.7. So that net change was a full percentage point drop just in the course of a month. And that's a huge decline for retail sales, but there was even more to that number than what was reported that I think a lot of the media overlooked, which is this is, and we've used this example talking about retail sales before, Adam, but you know, a tank of gas works so very well for this example, because you buy the same amount every time you fill up your tank for the most part. The tank will only hold so much. So if you run it dry every week and you fill it up every week, you buy the exact same amount of gasoline. The problem is you're spending a lot more for it. So we measure retail sales in dollars, right? How many dollars did we spend? So if I fill up my tank of gas last week at $4 and this week it's $5 a gallon, we note that there was an increase in retail sales because the price was higher. We didn't buy any more of gas. We just paid more for it, right? So when you're talking about a reversion in retail sales of a full 1% spread between the high point and the low point, that's the dollar volume decrease. Now, remember, prices are higher on everything. So we're talking about higher prices on food and gas and energy and everything else. So the actual decline in retail sales in terms of volume was much greater than what we saw in just the decline in the dollars spent. And that really tells you a lot more about that disinflationary pressure coming into the economy. Consumers are opting out of buying as much stuff because they can't afford it. And again, you and I have talked about the credit card increases and those type of things that we've seen here. They're having to go back to credit card debt to do this. But that deflationary pressure that's coming, it's here. We just haven't seen it reflected in the CPI calculation yet. And as we talked about this, I think last week, about 42% of CPI is homeowners equivalent rent. That runs about a 3-month lag because of what happened, how we push home prices through the system. It's kind of like a rat inside of a snake. It takes a while to get through there. But once it gets through into the system, and probably in the next month or so, we're going to see that disinflationary pressure in housing. I wrote an article in 2021 talking about why there is no such thing as a housing shortage. And remember, everybody's like, oh, house prices are going to go up forever because we just have a shortage of housing. Housing inventory has shot through the roof here lately because of two things. One, there never is a housing shortage because housing is always driven by the fringe activity of who's buying a house and who's selling a house. Well, as soon as you have high prices, a lot of sellers come to market and buyers evaporate. And so you have this very quick surge in supply, and that's exactly what's happened now. Now we have this huge impact of supply. And now that rates have gone up, everybody's rethinking, look, I could barely afford my mortgage at 4%. I can't even get close to affording that house now at 6.5% of my mortgage because the monthly payment's gone up $400 a month. So this is going to have a very big impact on the housing market. We're going to see that housing disinflation come into the CPI calculation by the end of the summer. And I think we'll be talking about substantially lower rates of inflation by the end of this year.
Great. And hey, on housing specifically, I just want to put up a couple of charts here. This is from an article on Zero Hedge, but 30-year fixed mortgage rates have now cracked above 6%. That has a very depressionary influence on people's appetite to buy houses. And just the way you're talking about, Lance, that's led to an unprecedented surge in home buyer mortgage payments. Just as you're saying, and I've got a chart here where it basically shows over the past, since the start of the year, they've gone from like below $1,750 average mortgage payment to now $2,500. It's a pretty big jump, making housing the most unaffordable in history. So here's a chart going back, over 30 years or so, showing that the unaffordability index or the affordability index has plunged to its lowest in the data series, which is also leading to new home sales plunging at the fastest pace since the peak of the COVID crisis, and home buyer sentiment imploding to the lowest level in generations. So, you know, this is all happening right now in real time, and prices really haven't come down that much yet. Yeah. And
They will,
as you and I have talked about a number of times in recent videos, so I won't go into all those reasons here, but it's yet another big shoe that's just beginning to drop now that's going to be, you know, compounding all this demand destruction that we're talking about. By the way, I did a video earlier this week. It's gotten a lot of views. A lot of people definitely seem to be hungry for this information, kind of going through all the different body blows that the consumer household is taking right now, and how that is going to likely depress consumer spending even further. And as you and I have talked about, Lance, that's 70% of GDP. So where the consumer goes, the economy goes. If you haven't watched that video yet, folks, and it's a very short one, I'll put up a link to it here. You can watch it after this video. But Lance, you know, so we just seem to have, you know, how do you want to describe this? The hits just kind of keep on coming here, right? So as I mentioned sort of a few minutes ago, while we're also focused on inflation and prices going up, you know, we could be going into a world here where all of a sudden, a lot of the demand that's been pushing those prices higher goes away. Maybe some of the supply issues get fixed as well. We may see prices for financial assets, for housing, for even just goods in the store, as those discounts begin to kick in that the Moody's analyst is warning about. It could literally be an entirely different world 6 months, 9 months from now. And by the way, I haven't yet talked about recessions. We are already beginning to see the beginning, layoffs. You and I have mentioned that the pretty dramatic uptick in activity that's begun over the past quarter, but I think that's just the very beginning of what we're going to see. Yeah. We're now just beginning to hear about bankruptcies, right? There was a Revlon declared bankruptcy earlier this week, late last week. So, you know, again, there's a whole other series of chapters to this demand destruction story that haven't played out yet here. So how concerned are you about this potentially like entirely different world we could be in 6 months, nine months from now?
I want to be careful. I'm trying to figure out the way I want to phrase this. I want to be careful how we put this out there. Because there's a whole group of people right now that when you say there's going to be an entirely different world, you know, they've got tinfoil hats on and we're talking about the Mad Max apocalypse here. And, you know, and there's certainly some elements of that right now. If you kind of look around the landscape, you know, we've got, you know, we're trying to get women to have more babies. We're trying to, we've got gas that scare us and can't afford gas. And, you know, we've got the whole world run by some guy named Biden and it's all going to shit. And, you know, and it's kind of got the whole Mad Max feel to it. And I get that. Right. But I want to be careful how we label this because I don't want people to run off to that end of the curve just at this moment. There are certainly some problems here. Your point, right? I don't see how we avoid a recession.
Yeah, and I'm sorry to interrupt because that's a great question, and I'm not trying to freak out anybody into panicked action. But sort of the spirit of the question is if we take stock of what people are really worried about right now, which is like supplies running out, which is prices chasing away from them, which is no housing out there, right? It's there's no inventory anymore. We may be in a world pretty soon where there's lots of housing inventory. These high gas prices have all of a sudden come down. I mean, it's almost going to be like opposite world. So Yeah. You can put your good or bad market on it, a label on it. I'm just saying it may be opposite of what we're so currently spun up about.
And I think that's a much better way to put it. I just, like I said, I don't, I get so many emails, and I get a lot of emails from even this channel of people going, the dollar's going to zero. And I just, I want to be all in gold. And look, that's fine, right? That's not the way the world works. And I just want to make sure that we kind of keep a realistic perspective on, kind of how to navigate this, because again, we can make decisions. And you and I have talked about this before. We can make a decision to be completely out of the market. We're going to be 100% cash. And that may work for right now. And now we're going to avoid the bear market. We're going to avoid the recession. And then you miss out on the entire next bull market. And this has happened. I've told you that, I'm still meeting with people today that have been out of the market since 2009, right? They missed the 400% advance in the market. That choice that they made was more destructive to them on growing their financial wealth and preparing them for retirement than if they would have just stayed invested, did a buy and hold strategy through the whole bear market in 2009 and just rode the market back up. They would have been better off. That's not the way to manage money, but they would have been better off.
Exactly. It's the classic Peter Lynch, more money's been lost. I'm butchering it, but more money's been lost, in preparation of the next bear market than was actually lost in the bear market or something like that.
No, it's absolutely right.
Yeah.
And so that's the only thing I want to couch our conversations in just kind of a basis of realism. So, here's my concern right now, as I started to say, was I don't see how we avoid a recession. The Fed's hiking rates, they're tapering their balance sheet. We're seeing, CEO confidence is at very negative levels, consumer confidence is at recessionary levels. I just wrote a report for Epic Times, and it's on our website today, talk about the NFIB. And the last time that we wrote about the NFIB warning about a recession,
can you just define the acronym?
Yeah, I was about to. Okay. Slow down.
Just looking out for our viewers.
I gotcha. But the National Federation of Independent Business is an organization that is comprised of small businesses all around the country, and small businesses are the backbone of the economy. Now, I'm not talking about small cap companies, right, that are publicly traded. They're in there too, but I'm talking about small, privately. I'm talking about, your local auto mechanic and your local hair salon and your local little manufacturing company. These are the members of NFIB chapters around the country. And they take a survey once a month. And right now, and again, the NFIB is not saying a recession is coming. The data is warning of a recession. And the last time that I wrote about the NFIB issuing a warning, a recession warning, was in September of 2019. And nobody believed it then. They're like, oh, we're not going to have a recession. Everything's great. 5 months later, we're in a recession. Now, did the NFIB know anything about an economic pandemic and a shutdown? No. But the data, the negative sentiment that was in the small business environment was already prepping the economy for recession. All it needed was a trigger. And that was that pandemic. And
it got a hell of a trigger, but yeah.
And and going back to our conversation earlier, if we have this type of, very major bear market recession type action where we're down 40, 50% from the peak of the market, it's going to take some unexpected exogenous event that the market is not pricing in. The market is pricing in a recession right now. The market is pricing in higher Fed rates. The market is pricing in a slowing housing market. The Fed, the market is pricing in, gas prices. That's what markets do. And this whole pressure we've been under since the beginning of the year is pricing in the things that we know about. And there are things out there that, I believe it was Dick Cheney, correct me if I'm wrong, says, there's the thing, the things we know and the things we don't know and the things we just don't know that we don't know.
Right. The unknown unknowns. It was Rumsfeld, but same administration.
Thank you for correcting me. I appreciate that. but that's the big risk. It's the unknown unknowns that typically break the markets, because that's, as we said earlier, the markets have to try to price in that unknown unknown very rapidly. In 2008, it was Lehman. Nobody, like I said before, I was sitting in my apartment. At that time, I'd sold my house, was trying to buy a new house. I'm sitting in an apartment and, you know, on a Friday night and Saturday morning, Lehman's in bankruptcy and the market's falling apart. Nobody knew Lehman was coming. And so all of a sudden, over the next 2-3 weeks, we're trying, the market's trying to price in what the hell does it mean when nobody wants to loan anybody collateral, right? So, you know, that, but that's the risk. That's the thing, you know, so if you know about it, and this is what there, here's my point about this. If you think you know a recession's coming, if you think you know the Fed's going to keep hiking rates, if you think the Fed is going to keep cutting their balance sheet, if you think the world is going to run out of food, if you think the gas prices are going to go to $200 a barrel and $10 a gallon in gas, if you think you know those things, the market's already priced those in. It's the things that you don't know that haven't been priced into the market yet. And that's the puck that we've got to be looking for. You know, one thing that kind of popped up on my radar this week was what's going on with the Japanese bond yields, which, you know, Japan has been trying to cap their bond yields at, I think, 25 basis points. Those things blew through that cap over the weekend and this week. That's potentially a risk here. The markets haven't priced in yet. And if things kind of go haywire in Japan, there's a lot of linkages between the Japanese economy and the U.S.
It's the third largest economy.
They are, and we do a lot of trade with them. They hold a lot of our bonds. And, you know, if something happens to their economy, that could be one of those credit-related events that the markets haven't priced in yet. So I think that's something worth watching, but we now know about it, and that's starting to get priced in as well. So again, these are so when we talk about, hey, next year could be a very different world, I absolutely agree with you, Adam. But what I want to caution listeners and viewers about this is if you are already betting on the end of the world, it's already been priced in.
Right. And I guess this is why I'm asking the question, which is at the end of the day, the individual who's managing their money has to decide which puck they're going to look at and where they think it's going. Right. And right now there are so many people that are looking at things like persistent high oil prices and, you know, tight housing inventory and hot inflation, you know, continuing to persist and whatnot. And what I'm trying to do is sort of raise the idea and maybe even the probability that a lot of that stuff isn't going to last forever because we have these massive demand destruction forces that are going to shift the direction of that puck. And so I guess there's two things I'd like to, you know, two points I'd like to make for the viewer. One is, if those are the things that you're really focused on, right, the hot inflation and that whole thing, reserve some bandwidth to, you know, in your strategy to say, okay, well, maybe Adam and Lance are what if they're correct? And can I put some elements into my portfolio that says, hey, you know, if they're correct, I've got some hedges that'll do okay in that case. But also just to the larger point of what you're making here, which is like, nobody knows anything for sure, right? So no matter what puck you choose, you always should have some hedges, or at least, you know, don't come up with a set it and forget it strategy that you just plan to walk away from, particularly in an environment that's this volatile right now. And so I guess my point here is just we it's almost like the Heisenberg principle, like the puck could go in a lot of directions here right now. Don't feel like, you know, if you're feeling super rock solid about what the future is going to be, it's probably a good sign there are some unknowns out there that you should be reserving some bandwidth, you know, in your plan for.
Well, and look, and this is how we manage our portfolio, right? You know, look, we own gold in our portfolio. We own, you know, energy stocks in our portfolio, right? So, you know, we see those opportunities, but we also own some stuff that is on the other side of that puck, so to speak, of, you know, what happens if, right? And I think that's, and you're absolutely right. That's the way you've got to kind of think about this is, what if I'm wrong, right? And that's the important thing here. And look, last, you know, 2 weeks ago, you could do no wrong owning energy stocks. All of a sudden, in just 3 days, it's completely reversed. You know, what happened? Nothing happened, right? And, you know, we didn't suddenly bring, you know, 50 million barrels of production online. That's not why oil prices went down as much as they did. You know, what happened, right? And so we can point to some different things, right? We can talk about the sharp spike in the dollar because of what happened to Japan. You know, that impacted oil prices potentially and caused a correction. We could talk about just you know, a lot of other things. We can assign a lot of causes, but the reality is that traders up in the COMEX went, I'm out. And you got this big correction, but you didn't know that was coming 2 weeks ago. And this is the important point about portfolio management is that sometimes you've got to make some bets and they may not work out for you right away, but they're there for a reason. They'll hedge you against risk. They'll help shield the portfolio against declines, but they also put you in a position that if your thesis doesn't work out, you're not kind of walking a tightrope without a net.
Yeah, great way to say it. And look, folks, if you're watching this and saying, oh gosh, this seems like such a lot of work. I gotta come up with my thesis. And then I sort of have to think of the antithesis of that in case I'm wrong. And then I've got to watch everything just to be nimble in case things change on the ground. I got to pivot. That's a big reason why we at Wealthion like just continue to bang the drum of saying, unless you're a super experienced investor like this, that's why you work with a professional financial advisor, right? You know, they're playing this role for you. They're the ones that are watching what's happening 24/7. They're the ones that are, you know, making the nimble calls when the situation calls for it. So anyways, I just want to reiterate that for folks, especially in the type of environment that we're currently in and that we might be heading into. If you're doing this solo, hopefully you got a lot of experience. And if you don't, that should be a strong sign to reach out to an advisor and talk to them. All right, Lance, two last things I want to talk about with you before we wrap this up. First one is the trades that you guys have made recently. You gave a quick nod to that by saying that sounds like you've taken off some of your hedges recently, but what trades have you guys made since the last week?
So we have been talking about over the last, 3 weeks that we were expecting kind of this rally, kind of a counter trend rally. And we got that, and markets was very interesting. Markets kind of rallied back up and then they just kind of flatlined for about 2 weeks and didn't really go anywhere. We were just trading up and down every day in a real flat line.
Yeah, and I mentioned you were nervous that they were burning off the oversold nature, which.
Yeah, exactly. And so right at the top of that level, we reduced some more of our equity holdings and added a position, a short S&P 500 position. And then kind of once, we started seeing this action kind of really breaking down this past week, we sold a little bit more equity earlier in the week on Monday, which worked out very beneficially because we missed that sharp down drop on Thursday post-Fed, but we were worried about what the Fed would say. So we raised a little bit more cash. We're currently running about 34% equities in our portfolio, about 35 to 40% cash, and the rest is a little bit of fixed income. We actually even reduced the short end of our fixed income portfolio. We had some very short kind of floating rate treasuries, and we have some 1 to 3 year treasuries. We actually, and some 5 to 7 year treasuries. We sold our 5 to 7 year treasuries this week because we're getting ready to move that into the long end 20 year treasury over the course of the next couple of months as we start to see this kind of peak in inflation and peak of economic activity. And we think the Fed's going to get caught here pretty quick. You know, the Fed may be able to run up another rate hike or two. I think they're going to get caught flat-footed here pretty quick now and trying to hike rates because I think the economy is going to buckle here sooner than later. And the problem with not being in that bond trade is that when bonds start to move, they're going to move so fast, you're not going to be able to get into them. So we're going to start building and adding into our current long duration treasury position over the course of the next couple of months leading up to that event. I don't know exactly when it occurs, but I would suspect by the end of this year, interest rates can be back below 3%.
Okay. And that's the TLT position that you've been talking about, which has been a longer term play, not a quick trade. You've been doing that in anticipation that the Fed is going to pivot. Sounds like you're maintaining your skepticism that the Fed's going to be able to deliver on all the rate hikes that it said it's going to do. At some point in there, something's going to break. And you think the Fed's going to have to switch from QT back to QE, correct?
So there's very few things that you can almost say is guaranteed to happen in the financial markets. It is almost guaranteed that the Fed is going to break something in the markets and the economy. So, this is really a low risk bet. It's been a painful trade this year by, all magnitudes because it's just been a tough trade to own bonds this year. But two things. One is that we've been buying a lot of individual bonds for portfolios this year that for the first time in 4 or 5 years, I mean, we're buying great companies, Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, Procter & Gamble, Berkshire Hathaway. We're buying great companies and we're getting yields of 4.5% on some of these bonds and fairly short durations. And we haven't been able to lock in yield into a portfolio at that level for the last several years. You know, prior to this, I mean, you were getting paid more to own a high yield junk bond and you were barely getting 1%. So, you know, for the first time, you can actually build income into a portfolio with principal preservation because those bonds will mature at face value and pay you back your principal. So that's been a really great opportunity. And then from a trading perspective, again, it is almost guaranteed the Fed is going to mess up, that they're going to create a monetary policy error at this point. And all roads lead to Rome. and with Jerome Powell going, I don't see a recession anywhere, that just pretty much cemented the position that I just want to own as much long duration treasury as I can get right now.
Got it. All roads lead to Jerome. Okay.
Exactly.
All right. Look, let's wrap this up. Let's try to end sort of on a fun point here.
Happy note.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're going to get to our rant, but it's going to be, it'll be interesting. All right. Well, look, we're talking about, you know, Fed could break something. And, you know, obviously that ties back to what we were talking about earlier, which is, you know, what are the implications of, you know, when it breaks? Does it break something so big that we end up having, you know, even bigger
issues?
Issues, demand destruction. You know, does the Fed tip us into a much bigger recession than we should be into? Whatever. Anyways, yes. Okay, great. but where I'm going with this is I've been getting a lot of really, I mean, I would say a lot of, you know, really heartwarming comments and emails from folks saying, hey, they really enjoy these weekend conversations. They also enjoy the other interviews that we do on Wealthion. But a really common theme through these is people saying, I'm finally learning about investing and money for the first time in my life. You know, I wasn't taught this growing up. I either didn't learn it in school or I didn't have a parent who sat me down and really, you know, explained all this to me. And so for the first time, I really feel like I'm getting an education in investing and just sort of the mechanics of how the economy works and whatnot. And one that's wonderful feedback to hear, because that is really sort of the primary mission of why we created Wealthion, is we wanted to sort of democratize financial literacy. And then the second part of that mission is we want to make it actionable for people, which is why we partner with firms like Lance. But it really does just sort of drive home what a terrible job. You know, we as one of, if not the most developed nations in the world, do in educating people about arguably, you know, one of the absolute most important things in their lives. The whole reason you go to get an education, right? You get an education because you want to provide a financial future for your family and you want to create options and opportunity and whatnot. And we just do an absolute terrible, terrible job. And, you know, this number of these comments are coming from, you know, doctors, lawyers, I mean, really highly educated people. They went through, and I'll tell you, I mean, I went to an Ivy League undergrad. I got my MBA at Stanford. You know, no one really ever just sat me down and said, hey, look, this is how you do basic household budget management. This is how you handle, you know, this is how you apply for a mortgage. This is how you handle credit debt. This is how you stick to a budget. I mean, just even basic practical stuff like that. It's amazing. So I'm seeing you nodding as I'm saying all this, Lance. I know you talk to people day in and day out who are working with you because nobody taught them about how to do this stuff and they're leveraging your expertise. But let's end with a rant here. Your thoughts on how poor, you know, what we could be doing differently as a nation here.
Well, no, I think it's a great point. You know, here's the problem, right? So, you know, we've ruined the financial advisory business, just absolutely destroyed it. And you know, we call people financial advisors. And look, I'm very fortunate. I have just, and Adam, I think you can vouch for the guys I work with. They are just phenomenally nice guys, extremely smart, dedicated to providing help and service for clients. And they do it. They have a real passion for helping people with their finances. And that's very unusual. And I'm not saying that there's not a lot of other financial advisors out there just like them, because there's a lot of financial advisors in the world. But when it comes to a lot of the financial advisory industry, we've really destroyed, you know, the whole purpose of having a guy work with you, right? You have a doctor, you get sick, you go to the doctor and you trust this doctor, right? He went to med school, he did all these type of things. And you trust him that whatever he's going to prescribe to you is the right thing. You know, when you get in trouble, you go to a lawyer, they take care of you, right? And because they've got the experience and knowledge and you trust them to do that. You have an accountant for those same things. And that's what your financial advisor is supposed to be. It's supposed to be a guy you go to and say, look, I need help managing my money. And I need help with getting my finances in place and doing those type of things. And the industry as a whole has destroyed that entire narrative. It's they pushed all these advisors to start doing buy and hold investing and, you know, just stick people in portfolios and don't worry about it and charge them a fee. And we've done all this other stuff within the industry to try to create an environment where supposedly I'm getting advice, but I'm not really getting any advice at all. I'm just, you know, kind of being slung into markets and hopefully they just go up over time. But the in order for a lot of this to occur, people that really need the most help and education, they don't have money, right? So the advisor doesn't want to work with them because they have no money, right? They can't, I can't charge you a fee on nothing. And so this, so they don't get access to the advice that they need. And the really good financial advisors of the world, they don't want to deal with clients that don't have, you know, half a million, a million, 2 million. I mean, there's people out there that I personally know financial advisors out there. They won't even touch you unless you've got $5 million or more. And that's because of capacity issues and a lot of other things. And there's reasons for that. And, but if you've got 5 million bucks, you can get really great financial advice about, you know, how to manage taxes and do these type of things. So, you know, we rant and rave about this financial inequality that we have in the country, right? 80% of people don't have any money. They can't, you know, meet a $500 emergency because they don't have any money in their savings account. We rant and rave about how evil all the rich people are. And they just have, you know, the top 10% of income earners have 90% of the assets. And as with all things in every society, there is always the rich and there's always the poor. It doesn't matter what society you're in. It doesn't matter what structure of economy you want. You want communism, socialism, capitalism, whatever, you know, aristocracies, monarchies, whatever, pick it, right? There's the rich and there's the poor and there's a whole bunch of people in the middle. That's just the way economies work out over time. What we've never done, and I don't see an easy solution for this, even in school, we do horrible things to children in schools in terms of financial education. We say, oh, we have a financial class, and okay, boys and girls, here you've got a mythical portfolio of $1 million, and whoever makes the most money by the end of the semester, you know, great, you know, you win. And so we create this whole investing competition, and all we do is teach kids to gamble for one semester. We didn't teach them how to balance a checkbook, as you said earlier, you know, why you don't take on credit card debt, why you know, how you navigate a mortgage and all these type of things. We don't teach them the real skill sets. You know, we should have, you know, when I was growing up, we had home economics class, right? I'm an old guy, right? I'm from the 70s and 60s and 70s. And so back in those days, right, home ec was how to bake, how to raise a
kid. Right, right. I was wondering why they called it home ec if you're, baking pies and stuff. Yeah,
exactly. You know, and I don't want to sound sexist and freak people out, but that's the way it was, right? But we need a home economics class, right? We need a curriculum that is a year or two or three or four through high school that is teaching, you know, how to balance a checkbook, you know, credit card debt, home economics of how to run a household. But then, you know, the basics of Graham Dodd investing, how to find fundamental value, how to do these type of things, you know, teach people how to invest in markets and over, right,
the importance
over a long
of diversification
period.
Yeah. And all that
stuff. And if you want to teach people how to invest, have a 4-year class that you have to go through, like through the, you know, freshman, sophomore, junior, senior in high school, you got a 4-year class. And you have this same class every semester. And for 4 years, you're running a portfolio through 4 years. So you get to go through a market cycle or so and see what happens over time, how markets respond. You know, I have people call me all the time. And they go, I want to get started investing. You know, what stocks do I buy? Don't buy any stocks. Take some money and go buy an S&P index and watch it. and learn what affects the price of that S&P index. What makes it go up? What makes it go down? What happens with different economic environments as you go through this for the first? And so for 3 or 4 or 5 years, just own an S&P index fund. Don't worry about buying individual stocks. Don't get wrapped up into that, because you've got to learn first. It's kind of like learning to ride a bike. You've got to start with training wheels, learn how to balance and ride on the bike, and then you take the training wheels off and you're good to go, right? So learn by buy an index and learn what makes it operate. Learn, or trying to learn how to fix your own car, right? Learn how the thing works, learn how to operate it. And then once you understand the broader dynamics that make the index go up and down, because the index, the rise and fall of the index affects about 80% of the stocks in the index. Once you learn that, then you can step back and start trying to break the index down into its individual components and try to buy the right components, right? But see, we don't teach those type of things. Everybody's immediately trying to, and you know, unfortunately, all these retail investors in 2020, 2021 thought they had Wall Street by the tail. You know, that was that outcome was obvious. It was just a function of time, right? Until, you know, the whole Bitcoin thing blew up and the retail meme stocks blew up. You know, Adam, you and I have been through this how many times, right? You know, we've seen these cycles come and go, and it's always the same. But we've got to start thinking about, if we really want to have better economic prosperity in the country, we've got to teach people how to manage their money. And, you know, we just don't want to do that. We don't want to teach people to save money. It's the paradox of thrift. If people save money, the economy slows down. So we don't want people to save money. We want them to spend everything they have, right? So, it's this
such
challenge.
An ass backward way to run a society, but yeah, I agree.
It is. But, and then we want to complain about the outcomes. And then in order to fix the outcome, we want people to give us stuff from the government for free, which only makes the outcomes worse longer term.
Exactly. But by not doing that, you're basically, you know, you're training people to become lifelong dependents, right? Which is not what you want for society. So, okay. So exactly. We're getting right in the rant territory. And look, we could really dial this up. We don't have a ton of time left to do it in, but just in beginning to close here, I love your idea there actually about kind of the four year course, right? You know, a high school's worth of portfolio management before you go off into the real world. I love that idea. And look, we might not be able to change society to start doing that in every high school tomorrow, but a lot of the viewers who have children, hey, you can. That's actually not a bad thing to do, is maybe to give your freshman a certain amount of money and say, hey, look, you know, this is yours to manage over the next 4 years. And whatever you end up with, you know, we're going to reduce the cost of your college debt by that or whatever. Yeah.
So that's what I do with my kids. You know, I give them some money to invest and however they want to do it. And I encourage that. Of course, I've told you before, you know, I'm an evil, wicked parent, because I make my kids work. As soon as they turn 16, they have to get a job. They have to pay for their own car. They have to pay for their insurance. They have to pay for their phone bills. You know, I want to make them responsible adults, but I encourage them to save money, and I put them on a matching program, just like a 401k plan. So if they save money, I'll match it. So I give them an incentive to do that. And then I try to help them start investing and start learning about, you know, the markets and how things work. And, you know, that's a bit of a challenge, because, you know, it's just, you know, they're young and it's hard to get this, but I'm trying to ingrain those kind of basics. And look, if you ever, you know, want to start an educational program, I'm happy to jump in and do it with you. We can create a whole series of videos on, you know, kind of the basics of, you know, financial management and economics. And I can drag, you know, Danny or Richard in to do some financial planning stuff with us. But if there's an appetite for this on, you know, with your viewers, and they're really interested in trying to figure out how to, you know, manage money better, happy to do it with you.
All right, great. Well, look, this is kind of where I was going. And I really appreciate you making that offer, which is, folks, we've had a couple of topics here. Retirement planning. Last week, we talked about insurance. You folks have said, hey, we're very interested in having a deep dive into those topics. So Lance and I have heard that. We are going to put together something, whether it's in one of these Saturday videos or whether we do something special for it, we're still figuring out. I'm kind of leaning towards the latter, but we have heard you. If you would like us to consider doing something similar for sort of teaching financial literacy to your kids, let us know in the comment section below. And here's the other thing I want to do to try to make today's video a little bit more interactive in an interesting way for everybody here. A couple of weeks ago, Lance, I was having a little bit of this rant on my Twitter account of how frustrated I was in how we poorly teach financial literacy in this country. And I got into a dialogue with a lot of my followers about, hey, what kind of opened your eyes to the value of money? What started you on your journey of going onto the internet and starting trying to learn more about this? And the answers were really interesting. And a lot of them were really moving. You know, these were people who had parents that were just very poorly educated and they saw what happened, you know, with their financial mismanagement. Some were people who, you know, had great misfortune in their lives and lost everything they had and had to start over. Some people had wonderful parents who did a lot of the stuff that you just talked about, and it just got ingrained with them at an early age. So I want to encourage you viewers to share your story in the comment section below here, because I think the more people who do, the more people who are going to see that, get inspired by it, share their own stories. It's going to be very interesting reading at a minimum, but also I think we're going to get some inspiration, like Lance's idea there about, you know, having the kids manage a portfolio during their high school years. We may get some really interesting ideas and some cross-pollination going on in there. And just to, you know, kind of put some skin in the game, I'm going to ask you, Lance, and then I'm going to answer myself too. What was the sort of defining moment in your life about money, where either you first sort of woke up to the importance of having to kind of be in control of your destiny around it, or some experience that just drove home for you the value that you have continued along with you now in terms of how you manage it?
Living out of my truck for 3 years.
Okay, that'll do it.
Taught me a lot.
And yeah. Was that by choice, or was that something happened?
Well, a little of both. When I just launched, it's a long detailed story. I won't get into the whole rub of it, but right out of college, and actually during college, I used to own a bunch of martial arts schools around the country, et cetera, and started building health and fitness facilities, and learned my lesson about bringing in the wrong investor into a company, and caused a whole big shakeup of the company. And basically I walked away from it at that point. And at that juncture, I'm very young in my life cycle. And so I decided that, you know, my next venture was going to be in, you know, marketing and financial management, because that's what I was good at. And I really enjoyed that a lot. And, you know, so I went, I thought I was just going to, and I go, well, if I can make it in Houston, Texas, I can make it anywhere in the world, right? So it's the fourth largest city in the country. And so I came to Houston. I didn't know where I was, you know, what I was doing, or where I was going. I was determined to do it. And I had this little Mazda B2200 pickup truck at the time. And I would park behind Gold's Gym at the time. I'd park there at night, sleep in my truck, get up in the morning, and I could afford the $9 a month membership. I go in and work out, I'd shower, and I'd go to work all day. And I was out hustling money and trying to, you know, raise money to start a company, and, you know, went through a lot of school of hard knocks that way. But, you know, that was that kind of defining moment that I said, A, first of all, you know, I learned my lesson about be careful who you go into business with, because it makes a whole lot of, don't just because somebody's willing to give you money to do something, make sure you understand and protect yourself. And so I learned some really valuable lesson from that. But, you know, that period of, you know, just, you know, trying to, you know, get a business started and get it going, get it up and running. And, you know, it just, that's a point in my life where I was like, I'm never going back to that again. And, you know, a lot of the, it's interesting because when you look at financial education, you said, well, you know, I'm gonna go online and start looking at, you know, learning how to be more financially educated. Some of the worst information ever is on the internet when you Google it, right? About how to invest and, you know, how to, you know, do financial planning. A lot of it is just absolute garbage because it's not the way that money really works. And, you know, all the things that we talk about here, trust me, if there's a financial mistake that can be made, I've made it. I have done just about everything possible that you can do to mess yourself up financially at some point or another. So I learned most of my stuff through hard knocks. It was just because it was either, you know, either through starting businesses and, you know, taking on risk. And look, I am super, and it's interesting, you know, because I talk about risk management, right? And so I'm very risk conscious, but I am a risk taker individually. And so it's kind of an interesting dichotomy. I'm willing to take on a lot of risk, and I've started multiple businesses in my life. I've bought and sold companies. I've done a lot of things because I learned those lessons, but you can't build wealth without taking risk. And that was something that my dad did teach me early on in life. And he was never wealthy. He was always, you know, super conservative. And he always told me, the biggest regret I have in my life is not taking the risk to do something great. And he taught me to, he says, look, if you take risk and fail, that's okay, because that's the stepping stone to success. And you may fail 50 times, but you've got to keep getting up and keep going. And the biggest mistake that people make, that I talk to a lot of times, and they go, I just can't, you know, get to where I want to be, is because they'll take the risk to do something, and as soon as they run into the first hurdle, they quit. And you can't do that. It's you know, being successful ultimately is like a boxing match. And every time you got to get knocked down, you've got to get back up and just keep going. And things get tough sometimes. Things get real tough, but you've got to keep plowing through it. And every time you plow through one of these things, it gives you more experience, and it makes the path to success that much easier.
Yeah. Very, very well said. And definitely it hits me, only because I am more risk averse by nature. Mm-hmm. And I've learned a lot of lessons the hard way. You've talked about not taking enough swings at the bat and leaning in and leaving opportunity behind. I've done okay in the end, but you know, when I've looked back, it's the risks I didn't take are the ones that I regret the most. Thanks for sharing your story. Sounds like there were two important elements to that. One is you got burned in a way that taught you a very valuable lesson going forward. And two, you had that struggle, of, you know, thinking big and just grinding away to make it happen. And over time, seeing that progress and learning how to build it. And going back to our conversations from a few videos ago, where we talked about, the Millionaire Next Door, and how a lot of self-made millionaires, their children end up basically spending all the money that the initial millionaire created, because they were protected from that struggle, right? And we talked about how you want to preserve some of that struggle for your kids, if you really care about them, because they need to develop those muscles to overcome adversity, to fail repeatedly, like yep. You're talking about, to learn and to get the confidence that says, hey, failure doesn't mean game over. Failure just means I pick myself up and I do it better next time, right?
Yeah.
So I see you nodding on that. So that's running right. Real late. Oh, go ahead.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, if you don't get up, you can't win.
Right. All right. Well, we're going to wrap things up here, but I did promise I'd share my story. I'll share it real quickly. My parents divorced when I was super young, so young I don't even remember the divorce, but grew up, you know, bouncing back and forth between parents, but mostly lived with my mother. There were just always sort of, the lack of money was always a really big part of our life. And I remember as a kid, during Hurricane Gloria, we lived in Connecticut, when it slammed into our part of the country. I remember being in the basement, watching the trees by our house just bend like wet spaghetti, and thinking, oh my God, this house is all we have. And if one of these trees lands on the house and breaks it, I have no idea how we're going to recover from that financially. And at the time, I didn't know anything about home insurance or anything like that. But I just remember that fear of like, oh my God, everything we have could be taken in the storm. And I remember how stressed out my mom was at that point. And I just said, I never want to be this vulnerable, you know, when I'm an adult, and I want to make sure that the people who depend on me don't feel that vulnerability either. And that's really what kind of started me on my journey of saying, okay, well then how can I make sure I'm financially, you know, resilient going forward? So anyways, folks, if you've got a story, please do share it in the comment section below. We're going to wrap things up here. Just as a reminder for folks, I reinforced earlier the importance of working with a financial professional. Definitely take everything you've heard in this video here as the kick in the pants from the universe to go talk to yours. If you don't have one, or would like to get the second opinion of somebody that understands all of the trends that we've talked about here, you can schedule one with Lance or with one of the other financial advisors that Wealthion endorses by going to wealthion.com and filling out the short form there. We'll put up the URL for that at the end of this video. It's coming up in just a second. If you enjoy these weekly market recaps with Lance, would like to see us do more, please support this channel by hitting the like button and then clicking on the subscribe button below if you haven't. And as I mentioned earlier, please, even if you've clicked that subscribe button, go down. And if that bell icon is not turned on, click it to turn it on. Lance, thanks so much for sharing another week here with me. And whatever happens next week, we'll be tracking it here a week from now. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.